writers. I know you love Serena Bowen, but have you read Serena Bowen? If you haven't, you should. First off, because her books are killer fun, and secondly, because everyone is a masterclass in pacing, characterization, and plot. And if you think plotting romance is easy because, quote, we know what's going to happen, unquote, then call me again after you've tried it. Her latest is The New Guy, but if you're new to her world, I strongly recommend Brooklyn Air. Bet you can't stop with just one. Find out more at serenabowen.com.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Dell'Antonia, and this is Hashtag Am Writing, the weekly podcast about writing all the things, short things, long things, pitches, proposals. We are, at least we try to be, the podcast about sitting down and getting your work done. I am, as previously stated, KJ Dell'Antonia, the author of 3 novels, The Chicken Sisters in Her Boots and Playing the Witch Card, as well as a nonfiction book and a former reporter and editor at the New York Times. And with me is Elizabeth Harris, who is actually still a longtime reporter at the New York Times. And she, more importantly, for the perspective of this podcast, is the author of the new debut novel, How to Sleep at Night, which I have just finished and really enjoyed. And what we are going to talk about is how hard it is to go from writing true things for editors at top speed to writing fun, untrue, but also true things for editors at a much slower speed. That's the plan anyway. Hi, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So yeah, so that's where I want to start. How long have you wanted to write fiction as well as nonfiction?
Oh my God, forever. Is that what everybody says? Forever.
No. So it's really funny. There's two kinds of, well, there's many kinds of writers, but two of the possible ways to divide people up are people who are become journalists because they think fiction is really hard, and people who write novels because they think journalism is really hard. And they often do switch around when they feel sort of grown up enough and, you know, able to switch. But that both of those people exist in the world. Are you the first kind?
I guess I'm, am I some version maybe of it? I guess I always wanted to be a novelist, but I also wanted to be able to pay my rent. So So that was sort of where that came from. And, you know, I like grew up in a household where like there were always at least 3 newspapers on the table and like that kind of thing. And so, and I really enjoyed watching the news in middle school. Like I've always been kind of a news person, but like the thing I always really wanted to do was write books, but I had no idea, you know, no one was like writing me checks for nothing. So I was like, I need to get a job. And I love journalism, and working at the New York Times, as I'm sure you recall, is very busy. I've been there forever now. God, I've been there since I was 22, and I am no longer 22. I'll tell you, I'm 41, so I've been there for almost 20 years. And so I never had the actual like minutes in the day nor the brain space, you know, for a really long time to really think about it. But I've always been a reader, and I never like the desire to do it never went away. But I sort of suddenly, for a variety of reasons, had a little bit more time, basically because of COVID. And so I thought, well, you know, I mean, I don't know, it's jumping ahead, but I basically was, it was late 2021, and my kids were back at school full time, thank God. And my wife, who is a doctor, never stopped going to work. So suddenly, but I wasn't really going to work still. So paper wasn't really fully back at all. And I cover publishing, which was still totally remote. And so I kind of looked around, and I had this idea. And I was like, well, I have an hour and a half a day when I would normally be on the train. So I might as well just like see what I can do. And that was where it started. But I have wanted to do this forever. And I have I've always been a big reader. And so I've tried to read, like in the couple of years leading up to it, I think I was like very intentionally trying to read as someone who wanted to write a book. But that was sort of as far as my actual planning went. So, yeah.
So I kind of want to follow that up with, sometimes I read as a writer, and sometimes I read as a reader, and sometimes I mean to read as a writer, but I end up reading as a reader, and sometimes
usually
it works the other way around. And if it works the other way around, it's usually because the novelist has failed.
Right.
And if I'm suddenly reading as a writer, it's because you caught my attention in some way that you probably did not. So what is it? What does that mean to read as a future writer?
How did you approach it? Yeah, I mean, I totally would do the thing where I'm like, okay, I'm excited about this book, so I'm going to try and pay attention to like what they're doing and what works and mm-hmm. what I like, and then I forget, and I'm like, whoa, that was a good ride. Oh, what happened, right? So I'm not that good at it still, but I do try to think about, you know, if there's a book, but often it's a rereading process more. Like if I really loved a book, then I'll reread it. I'm not a big rereader naturally, but in the last few years, I started doing it more because I was like, you know, Fates and Furies, for example, I was like, wow, how did she do that? You know? And so I was like, okay, I'm going to go back and I'm going to look at how she did it. Right. And mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And just sort of trying to pay attention to the pacing and the structure in a way that those I think are the things for me that are so different from journalism, right? Like, I mean, everything is different from journalism in terms of the writing, but that's like a huge one, right? Like just sort of dumping everything you have into as short a format as you possibly can while also doing it justice versus like taking people on a ride that's actually going to like have an emotional journey, which is slightly different.
Yeah. I just was getting a note from somebody that was reading something of mine this morning that was like, okay, slow down, let it unfold, trust the reader.
Mm.
One thing I notice about your paragraphs is they tend to be very dense.
I wonder why.
You don't say.
You wonder why that is.
Where did that come from?
Yeah. I'm working on a second novel now, and I just sent it to some first readers, and in my little email of what to pay attention to, pacing was one of it, and hopefully they don't hear this before they finish it, but the thing I wanted to say was like, is the ending too fast? Because I tend to do things, right? I tend to truncate things too much, so I need to,
Oops, I'm out of words.
Exactly. And we're done. Everyone's done, right? We're done? Exactly.
And the thing happened, and boom.
Yes.
You know, the reader's kind of like,
Where did she go?
Yeah. I'm still here.
Exactly.
Give me more.
So try not to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, try not to do that. Or you can just, you know, the other black girl, the whole thing, and just throw one character out the window and bring in another to end the story, which was cool. And like her thing. But it was like, as a reader, I was like, wait, whoa, what? That was a fun one.
Secondly.
So, one of the things that I have really struggled with in going from, you know, journalism to writing fiction is this deep inner need to only write things that could possibly happen and to spend a lot of time on like, well, okay, so if that was going to happen, how would probably the reader is going to be like, oh, but hold on, that bus does not go along that. So they're going to know that. So I'm going to need to explain, you know, that on this day there was a traffic jam. And so the bus went does that ring a bell for you?
Yes, totally. I'm very concerned about things feeling real 100%. And because it's like, I mean, it's such a different part of your brain, right? Like, mm-hmm. but it's still all connected. And it's really, you know, like it's hard to untrain yourself from, from the like, you're searching for the detail that's going to make the story work. And you're searching for the detail that's going to make this scene work. But also you could just make the detail
that's
work.
The thing I have begun to read for is like, how much detail is necessary? Mm. So I read a book recently where like the whole thing turned on one of the characters needing to get money to pay for a medical thing for a different character. And if that were me, I would have been like, and this is how they got, you know, and this is why, and this is why their insurance doesn't cover it. And they tried to get health. My tendency to put health insurance in my novels, which is really enormous because it like,
I guess it occupies a large chunk of my
brain.
Yes. And this book, which was very popular and very beloved, it's a Christina Loren book, and it's I didn't love the title because it didn't have a lot to do. I think it was like twice in a full moon or something like that. Anyway, it's older. I just happened to be reading it. And this motivation for this, it's a romance. So one of the main guy character to do a really terrible thing, really hinged on this illness. They just say illness. Well, they were sick. Like, you don't care as a reader, because you've been dying to know why he did this, because it didn't make any sense. And of course, it's a romance, so it's a little bit of a different circumstance. But I'm always noticing like those moments where somebody else is just able to gloss over something that I would have spent a chapter on and then had to take out.
Totally. I don't know that I constitutionally will be able to like not know that it's possible that it's real, though. Like, I'm like, never even occurred to me, like, absolutely, like, cutting all these stuff about, like, I absolutely do that too, where it's like, I've explained all the ways in which no one cares about my explanation. I'll get rid of it.
In this book, the ways in which the person could have gotten into an article that they weren't supposed to, like,
right.
They were very recognizable to someone who has shared. And I was like, oh, yep, and I'm not saying it wasn't necessary. You needed to know that, but it was still, I spotted it as like,
totally,
you know.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. I mean, I feel like that's such an interesting thought, because I feel like as a reader, it does bother me. Like, I don't necessarily want all the details, but it bothers me if I think things don't, you know, if it doesn't seem possible, I'm like,
if it totally doesn't work, no. But if it like, either seems to work or I'm on the ride and I'm willing, like I'll often let one thing go depending on the book and the context. But yeah, like there was another book that I was reading lately where the social media reaction to something was so not what it would really have been. That I liked the character. I liked everything else about it. It was an advanced copy, but I just couldn't read it. Cause I was like, that's just not how this would go. It's not how it has gone. Like, we've seen this particular thing play out since this, anyway. And other people might be fine with it, but I
couldn't. Totally. I feel like that's the danger, right? Of like, if it doesn't have to be real, but if it doesn't feel recognizable, you're going to lose people, because then they're going to be like, no, right? Unless, in different circumstances, like in the illness book, sometimes people don't care. They're there for the ride, whatever. But I do think like,
right. That one just didn't need the specifics of, you know, it was Alzheimer's and they developed it in 97 or whatever. It didn't matter.
Totally. But there's also like expectations of the, you know, like of the genres and all of that stuff, and like a certain level of suspending disbelief in one kind of book versus another, and like how much people are going to be like holding your feet to the fire of whatever. So it's interesting.
The other thing I find hard, which you totally pulled off in How to Sleep at Night, and I forget if I said that was the name of the book, but I hope I did, because it's a great title.
Thank you.
Anyway, you totally pulled this off. Oh, it's good.
Yeah, she did good.
Which is, you need big things to happen. Like, I have the tendency to be like, well, that's probably too much. Like, it probably wouldn't be that big. Did you struggle with that?
A little. Like, let's see. I had a reader at some point who did tell me go bigger. And I found that very helpful. I mean, I forgot, how did she put it? It was, I think it might have been let bad things happen to your characters. And which, you know, I mean, this is nothing terrible, you know, no one dies, you know, like but bad things happen. Really unpleasant things happen in
people
this book.
People make mistakes and then things happen.
Exactly. Yes. Things absolutely happen.
Because if they don't, it's a really boring book.
Exactly. Things absolutely happen in this book. And a lot of the things already happened by the time this person read it, but she was like, you know, kind of like, you can make it worse.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. Serena and I have a saying, which is, don't make it more complicated, make it worse.
That's
we're both complicators.
That's a very, very good, that is a very good rule of thumb. I like that. Totally.
Despite not being a journalist, she also has a tendency to explain where the bus exactly, where the route.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's so interesting, like, how, like, just to go back to that one for one more second, is like, it's interesting the stuff you feel like you have to write but then you can delete. But if I don't write it, sometimes I feel like, why? I don't know yet, right? Even if no one else cares at all.
I need to know.
I need to know. You might not need to know, but I need to know.
I have to have a timeline.
Yeah.
Like, I need to know, like, you know, when the person was born, when they graduated from thing. I mean, those are pretty basic, but, and I often need, like, and when their parents, and, like, why their parents would have named them such and such. Like, I have to have all that, but I don't have to put it in the book.
Yeah. But, and going back to the, like, making things worse thing, I mean, one thing that I think was, like, has really been trained into me as a journalist is, like, the idea that you have to earn every second of people's attention, right? You know, like, the world is in their pocket. If they are bored, they're going to put your book down, and they will probably never be back up again, right? And that's fair, right? And so I think on every single page, I had this very deliberate idea of, like, don't be boring. Like, whatever you're doing, never let it be boring. And when I was in the sort of final cutting phase, because it got too long at one point, and I cut, I want to say it was about almost 20,000 words out of the book at the end, right? And my editor was wonderful, and I was like, it's too long. And she's like, I think you're right, it's too long. And she was like, just do what you need to do and bring it back, we'll make sure it works, basically. And I just, like, just slashed it.
And it's very tight.
Thank you. I tried, my little journalist heart just overjoyed to hear that. And, you know, there's a lot of, but yeah, like that very deliberate thing of just, like, try and make sure, like, every page has a purpose, everything is moving, and, like, things happen. And so it's not, you know, anything that got kind of navel-gazy, gone. So
I'm glad you bring that up, because that's another thing that I have found it was difficult in going from nonfiction to fiction. The interior dialogue. You have great interior dialogue in this.
Thank you.
There is no interior dialogue in journalism.
No. Like,
there's no, that's just not a thing. There's no crying in baseball. There's no interior dialogue in journalism. So how did you pull that off?
That's a really interesting question. No one has asked me that. That's, I think, and again, I'm making this up as I go along, but I think of interior dialogue the same way I think of dialogue. Like, I think of someone talking to themselves in their own head. And so all the dialogue I always do out loud. I mean, I kind of do everything out loud. So I sort of mutter to myself like a crazy person when I'm ready.
But I make faces too.
There you go. Exactly. But the dialogue is always, like, spoken as though somebody is speaking. And I guess I do the same thing with interior dialogue as well. Just sort of somebody is sort of having this little conversation with themselves. So, yeah, I think that would be it. I think the thing that I found the hardest going from journalism to fiction is summary, because there's a lot of summarizing in journalism, you know, and like, you have to take 1,000-page report and summarize it for people, or you have to summarize, like, everything that's happened in the last 3 years on this subject in 2 paragraphs or whatever it is. But the tendency to summarize stuff as opposed to, like, show it was, you know, that was like a real shift in, like, oh, that's not how this works, because this is boring. If I'm summarizing things for you, you want to see the people doing the things, right? That was like a moment of, like, a little light bulb for me.
I hadn't thought of that one as a journalism thing, but I get that a lot. Like, put that on the page.
Right.
Like, that scene that you just told me happened,
right.
We want to see that. And sometimes you're cheating because you just don't want to write it.
But and sometimes
the
scene
of the
is boring.
It's more, if the scene is boring, then make it interesting.
Right, totally. But some things don't need to be a whole scene. They can be a sentence, but you can't have too much of it. And if you do, then there's something wrong with your story, right? Because then it's kind of lifeless. So. Whereas, like, no one is going to read your 17,000-word newspaper story about this kind of minor happening and whatever, like, with all the characters and all the scenes. Like, no, they want to read 700 words and move on with their lives.
Max.
Yeah.
Or they might just read the top and the bottom.
Exactly.
Or just the top. Or just the headline.
Just the summary. And then they feel they've got it and they keep moving.
Or just the lines under the pictures that
say. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Has writing the book changed your journalism in any way?
Let's see. I think a little bit. I mean, I would say in terms of the writing, I would say writing the book has changed.
I meant in terms of the writing, not in terms of, like, what you are covering or how you are covering.
Totally. The writing, I would say it has a little bit, like, it's given me... It gives me a little bit more, I think it gave me more confidence in some ways. Like, I definitely feel like, you know, I've been at the New York Times a long time, and I can write you a story on anything very quickly, and that's fine. But like, this is like a confidence in something different, and allowed, I think it gave me a little bit more, I don't know, sort of emotional freedom to like kind of go for it a little bit more in some ways. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Beyond that, it will be interesting to see after the second book how much it is different, because the first book I wrote was, it was in like, it was insane. It like almost killed me.
Yeah.
So I was working, it started in 2021. I was working full time. My kids were, I think, 3 and 5 when I started. My wife is a doctor. She's also very busy. And it was still COVID. So there wasn't that much, like, socially, there was like less going on. My kids were so little, which at the time seemed crazy, but also in retrospect, actually was easier in some ways, because my older one now has baseball like 4 times a week and I have to get him there. Right. And so, but basically the way I did the first one was I, kind of cut out everything else. Like, I made sure I was like a good parent and a decent spouse. I made sure I was good at my job, and I wrote this book, and that's really it. Like, I stopped watching TV, I stopped watching movies, I basically stopped listening to music because I could like do dishes and think or whatever it was, and like anything that wasn't those sort of main things had to go. And it was also just like a, you know, my wife was an absolute hero, like, because it went from just being my commute to then also being after the kids went to bed. And then we found 2 hours on a Saturday and 2 hours every Sunday for me to, you know, and it just sort of, you know, eked into more and more stuff. Mm-hmm. But it also meant that I was, the actual act of writing was like 1.5 hours here, 1 hour there, 40 minutes here, 20 minutes there, you know, and it was, it's sort of very like, you know, and then it was, you know, edited and edited. Then I smoothed it out and made it function as a story. Yeah. But, it was the act of writing in that way was certainly different, but it was a little bit more similar to writing a story, right? Because
right.
you don't spend
this time you're on book leave, right?
Exactly.
So that's a thing that Times does. You can take a certain period of time to write a book. They didn't pay me to do it.
No, they don't pay you.
You don't have to. Yeah, no. They don't pay you, but you can do it, and your job is still there.
Yeah, which is amazing, right? So, you don't have to quit. It's awesome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but how is that different when now this is your job for the moment?
Totally. It's different. It's like very different that you're able to like sit in it and like really, you know, like you get very good as a reporter is splitting your attention, right? About like you have your writing but also
maybe interviewing for one story and writing another.
100%, right? Like you have the 2 documents open. If someone calls you back, you pick it up and you stop what you're doing, you know, and you switch, you're very good at switching gears. But now like actually just being able to like, I have, you know, 9 hours during the day when no one's home and I'm just doing it, and it's amazing. Yeah, and I feel like that has, like the actual process is so different. So I'm very curious to see what it will be like going back to writing stories after doing that, and if it's gonna like really change it. What do you think? How has it changed you?
Well, I didn't go back to journalism. Fair enough.
Do you ever do journalism?
No.
No. Well, then I guess then never mind.
I mean, you know, as you know, when you publish a book, they try to get you to, you know, submit and do some things, and so I've done that. But I think, I mean, I fundamentally wrote, like, I wrote 2 or 3 things a day for years.
Yeah.
I've been empty for a long time. It's only recently that I've started to think, oh, it's possible I have some nonfiction things. But for the longest time, it was just gone. Like, that well was so dry.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
Yeah. And in terms of like reporting stories, you know, nobody needs me to do that. There's plenty of people that want to do that. So to pitch it from not having it, it's not worth the.
That makes
not
sense.
A good way to spend my time.
That makes absolute sense. But yeah, so I guess then the answer is we'll see. I have no idea.
Yeah.
But so far,
find out.
So far, it's definitely been good. I mean, I definitely felt like, I don't know, I wasn't able to have, you know, it was, there were things that were just sort of fun about it. And it's like, you know, I don't know, like playing the instrument differently. So, yeah.
I mean, I guess another question is that the other reason that I rarely write nonfiction and I'm only just finding it back is that I've had a really hard time killing my Times voice.
It's
a different voice.
It's a voice.
It's maybe not your voice. And I found that a struggle in fiction a little bit as well. Does that sound familiar? Do you have a Times voice?
I 100% have a Times. I mean, I was like, grew up there, right? Like, I was, you know, 100%.
And you did it 20 years ago when the copy editors were like, I'm sorry.
Oh,
you can't say that.
Uh-huh.
No, you won't be using this clickbait headline.
100%. And I loved the copy desk,
poop,
by the way.
Not going to appear in this. You cannot imply that someone swore. And, you know, we're going to go and, the times has also changed. It's a looser place than it was you'd started. So presumably you've changed a little bit too.
Very true. And my groan was not about the copy desk being, the copy desk was wonderful. They were absolutely wonderful. It was about, well, I forget what you were saying, but it was anyway, yes, it was that specific example, but they were wonderful. But also it is good that it is now a looser place, right? Because this is how people read and all of that. I was really conscious of that when I started the first book, because I think that's, even changing at the times, like trying to loosen up at the times, that was hard for me at first. Yeah. Cause it was so ingrained in me and being like, oh, okay, all right, we can loosen up. And like, it was fine. And I did it, but it took like a real conscious effort.
Yeah.
And so I was aware of that when I started trying to write the novel and was like, okay, no Mrs. New York Times here. Like, no. And it was very deliberate. But yeah, I mean, that's like, it's such a thing that's really drilled into you in this very particular way of speaking to the reader. And yeah, no, and I tried really hard. And in some ways, I wonder if that helped in a way, kind of getting the characters' voices, because I was so careful not to use my own, because I was like, I will sound like the New York Times if I'm on autopilot. So who is this person and how do they talk? And what, you know what I mean? So I don't know. It was a good question. I hadn't thought about that, but I wonder if that did play a part. So yeah.
It's possible that you won't get another interview her that has done that. It's not the most common thing. I mean, people definitely do. Most, I find a lot of the people I interview from the Times that have written something, it's a nonfiction. It's,
oh yeah.
Maybe it's essays or it's
totally. Yeah. It's very funny, like the, you know, like as you said, like, so like book leave is like a thing. There are always a couple people on book leave because so many people write books, but almost everybody writes nonfiction. I think I'm aware of like two other people on staff currently who write fiction. And it's very funny, just like in the elevator, people like, how are you doing? Oh, I'm about to go on book leave. Oh, what are you writing about? Oh, it's a novel. A what? You know, everyone's like shocked.
Yeah, it's not like a deeper dive into whatever your topic is that you already have most of the information about. Yeah.
Exactly.
I already did that.
Yeah.
Did do that. So.
Yeah. I never did do that.
It felt required.
Yeah. You know, I thought about it, but I feel like, I don't know. I think maybe it was because I've always wanted to write fiction. And so I didn't want to use my like book brain for that. So,
but
I sort of feel like I write, you know, I love journalism and I write nonfiction all day and I'm like, this is great. But then I want to do something else. And at the end of the day, it was reading or whatever it was. And now it's this. So, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But.
So you do cover the publishing industry, but you do not review books, which I think is I will not review books. Not that people are clamoring, but that would be hard. So, but has this changed the way you cover the industry or the way you think about it?
I mean, in some ways it has. I think, I don't review books and personally, I think it would be very hard for me. And I think it's really important that people do. And I think people do a wonderful job.
Yes,
but it's just not my...
I love that people do it.
Yeah. It's just not my... Like, it's just not my interest in doing it myself.
Yeah.
Let's see. So I write about, like, the industry. I write profiles of authors. I write about, like, you know, book talk and, like, whatever and things like that or book banning. I would say, has this changed it? I think one thing that will be interesting when I go back, because I started book leave before my first book came out, which was very intentional because I wanted to have, because I'm writing the second book and I wanted to have like a good chunk of a first draft out before the first book came out.
Yeah, that's really important.
Get in my own head. I think it will make, I think this will make me better, but like I get, you know, hundreds of pitches a week about books, individual titles. Right, exactly. And I always felt bad, but now I'm going to feel really bad. You know, and like, I think it will, you know, and you do, you know, as like, as any reporter at the New York Times, you get hundreds of emails a day and it's impossible. Like if you spent your life responding to
you
every
email. You can't respond to them.
You
yeah,
can't.
No,
and I feel terrible,
you
but
can't.
You physically, there are not enough hours in the day. Right. And,
yep.
So, but I think that will make it harder to like make individual coverage decisions a little bit, because it won't just be like, you know, it'll be like, oh God, like here's like years of somebody's life and whatever. But ultimately, yeah, the way you make the decision has to be serving the Times reader. So like the decisions won't change, but I will feel more guilty, I think.
Great. Just what you needed.
Exactly. But beyond that, I'm not sure. I think like it's stuff that I knew kind of intellectually is indeed true, I guess. Like, you know, I mean, when I started writing the book, I very much wrote it as like, okay, the odds of any publisher ever buying this are extremely low, right? Like, and so you have to just enjoy writing it, right? And mm-hmm. And then someone did buy it, which was very lucky and wonderful. But sort of every step along the way, it's been sort of like these things that I'm kind of dimly aware of coming true has been very interesting. And I mean, there's definitely a lot of things I know nothing about. Like I knew nothing about how sales worked, like the people who sell the book to the bookstores, for example. Like that's like is something as a reporter was like totally, totally mysterious to me. And now I get it a little bit more. But yeah, I don't know. I would say it's been, it'll be interesting to see when I go back also what it feels like to cover mm-hmm. it. So I don't know.
All right. Well, just leaving the topic of journalism versus fiction. Now I want to talk specifically about How to Sleep at Night. So this is a book about, it's about a lot of things, but the plot fundamentally is that it's a gay couple who are not on the same side of the aisle politically, and the Republican guy decides to run for Congress, and his husband is not a fan of the decision to run, not a fan of his politics, not a fan of the compromises he has to make to run, which, I mean, that's so topical. And I just, you wrote it in 2021. It hasn't changed. How, you know, and I wonder if you hesitated around writing about such a seriously hot button issue, or if you like grabbed it because you're a journalism and that's what lights you up, or because you're a journalist.
I think I am journalism. I like it. I would say I wanted, I think some of it was that it didn't feel like it was going to change, right? And that like I was sort of like, you know, it takes years for books to come out. And I think I am, as a journalist, sort of interested in sort of like topical things, but I wanted it to be a topical thing that wasn't going to be gone in a year or two or three, right? And, you know, I think part of it was also I was thinking through some of this stuff myself. Like, I think everyone in this country is dealing with this to some degree, like whether it's in your family or your town or not, like it's in the country, people who don't agree with you, right? And like, unless mm-hmm. you are moving, like you are having to figure out how to live with that. And I do have people in my family I disagree with. And I was trying to figure out, you know, I was sort of thinking about that. And the original little germ of the story came from, there are several couples in my extended family who don't agree with their spouses politically. And they're, you know, it's, I don't think it's ever been like anyone's like favorite thing in the world about their marriage, but it has become harder in the last 10 years. But yeah, they're all still married and they're all still happily married. And I find that like interesting and kind of inspiring. And like, you know, I was like, God, like, how do they do it? And then I sort of had a thought one day of like, God, it would be terrible if one of them ran for office. It would be terrible if one of them, how interesting, you know? And so I think that was sort of, you know, it. And it was, seemed like it's more interesting as a story if, you know, these are happily married people who take good care of each other. But they have this difference that's kind of grown more and more pronounced and more difficult over the years. And then how do you live with that? And I mean, there's another couple in the book who also don't agree with each other politically, but it's like not the center of their story. Yeah. And it's, that was also kind of an interesting thing I thought to explore a little bit, because in talking to, like, I didn't have a lot of time to do research for this book, but one of the few things I did do was talk to people who don't agree with their spouses about this stuff. And it, some people, you know, it's a bigger issue for some people than for others. Some people just like aren't very political people. They just don't talk about it. Right. And
right,
it irritates them and they occasionally fight about it and then they don't talk about it for 6 months. Right. But then there are other people who are more politically engaged just naturally and it's harder for them. So, you know, trying to get both of those things. But yeah, the book is about is about those things, but I also tried hard not to make it a book about politics. Like, I really wanted it to be a book about marriage and a book about relationships and not a book about, like, a campaign. Like, I didn't want to spend 300 pages in somebody's campaign. Like, I don't know. Like, we got enough of that. But sort of the, like, how that decision impacts his family is interesting. And then there's sort of thematically this whole, like, the main theme of the book is sort of, like, well, I guess if there are two, it's how do you sleep at, like, how to sleep at night comes from the idea of, like, how far can you go to support someone you love without compromising your own values? Or with the other, there's another sort of central couple in the book, which is two women, and how far do you go to, like, build a life that you want at the expense of your family, essentially. And so everyone's sort of dealing with those things. And then the other is the other sort of central theme is the idea that you, like, there are these three people who are, exist in the world in a way they don't, like, who they are in the world doesn't match how they see themselves, essentially. And so you get kind of lost in, you know, and you're kind of scrambling to get your hands back on the wheel of your own life. So I was trying to sort of keep it from getting too bogged down in, like, not actually about politics, but about how families can, like, try and live through it, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, and it definitely achieves that. You can't have a gay guy that runs for, you know, Congress as a Republican and not touch on what his partner would disagree with.
Yeah.
Or might disagree with, because, you know, presumably
people, all
you
kinds.
Could also have two people that did not. But it didn't pull the story. I, too, have family members who I'm not on the same, and I really struggle with it. This didn't light that. It didn't light that match in me I was a little bit afraid that it would. So
I'm glad that it didn't.
So that's good.
Yeah. Great. Good.
Is the next one politics too?
No, the next one is not. The next one is about a relationship between two women that starts in the 1950s, and you follow them for about 60 years, and through them you see how much being gay in America changed in one lifetime.
Wow. Okay. Cool.
Totally
but
different.
Also, they have, like, but also, they, you know, they change, right?
Yeah. There's stuff happens. Lots of stuff happens. So hopefully, hopefully it's a good read. So knock on wood. We're still
working.
Still
working on it.
Working on it.
It'll be a good read. What it is now is what it
is. Yeah, exactly. Like, currently, whatever. But it'll get there.
Currently,
hopefully.
It's a pile of flaming. But maybe, or maybe not. Currently, maybe it's almost ready. I don't know.
No, not ready. Not ready.
Yeah. Well, this was great. We usually end an episode by asking our guests what they've been reading lately.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot to warn you about that.
That's okay.
If you can think for a second about something that you've read lately and liked, we would love to hear about it.
Absolutely. I have been doing a lot of research for my next book. And so I've been reading a lot of, like, queer history and memoirs and novels that include gay people that were set in various times over the last 70 years. And one book that I read that I absolutely loved was a memoir called Naked in the Promised Land, which is such a good title, by a woman named Lillian Faderman, who is in her 80s now. She was an academic, and she's written a lot of books about queer history in America. And but she's also just lived this, like, crazy interesting life, and it's about all kinds of things, but it's also she's a lesbian. It's about her growing up as a lesbian in the 50s, and but also about how she worked her way through high school and college, like dancing burlesque and being a pinup model, and, like, it's all kinds of just, like, crazy stuff, and she's funny, and it's 1000% recommend that book.
That sounds amazing. So I'm also going to go nonfiction, even though we're talking about fiction here. So I just finished Didion and Babbitt's, which I would describe as a biography of a frenemyship. and I am not, like, a Joan Didion stan. You know, I'm not someone that has read everyone. In fact, I'm a basic person who read the one about her husband's death, and I'm not even sure I finished it. And I didn't even know who Eve Babbitt's was until I read this book. But wow. It is, I mean, it's a time, and theirs was a really fascinating relationship between writers who were, competitors, but not, and really, like, one of them would be on top, and one of them, and they never admitted to any sense of competition, and they're such different people. It's really, really fascinating. Plus, it's this amazing look at, and which is totally unexpected for me, it's Hollywood in the in the 70s and 80s, which there's this great moment when, so this is a biography. It's written by Lily, I don't remember her last name. And she definitely interviewed Eve Babbitts. She did not, I think, talk to Joan Didion before she died, but all the other people, most of them are still around. So there's this moment when she's interviewing Michelle Phillips of the band The Mamas and the Papas, and Michelle Phillips is describing being dragged to see Star Wars, you know, in the morning, one morning after some party. She didn't really want to see it. And they're this very integral Hollywood clique, all of them. And Michelle Phillips describes looking up at the screen and Harrison Ford comes on as Han Solo. And she says, "Hey, that's my pot dealer."
That's so good.
I mean, and there's people all throughout this that you just don't associate. Like, who knew that Harrison Ford and Joan Didion really come from, like, the same roots in Hollywood? Mm-hmm. I had no idea. So, anyway, super cool book. Really,
awesome.
Really fun.
I'll pick that up. That's great.
All right. Well, this was fantastic. Everybody who's listening, go look for How to Sleep at Night by Elizabeth Harris. It has this gorgeous blue and New York-y cover, as it should. And I'm showing it to Liz because she's never seen it, even though you all can't see it. But you will enjoy it. So check it out. And thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you. This was really fun. Thank you for having me.
Oh, is there anywhere people should read your stuff in the Times when you go back? But how's your social media situation? Is it useful for people to follow you somewhere?
I mean, they can follow me on Instagram. It's Lizzie, LIZZYA Harris. But, you know, I'm like mediocre at social media.
Well,
but I'm trying.
I mean, it's a weird thing as a journalist. They totally bugged me to do it all the time. But anyway, okay, everybody, thanks for listening. And until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Thank you.